We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. And we're also happy to have here on the program once again Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from the Carl Physician Group in Urbana. Been here before on the show, and we're pleased to have him here as a resource to answer questions. There are a number of things we thought we might talk about. Many things that come under the general heading of safety, particularly in summer. He is here to do his best to answer questions as well. We have somebody here who is all ready to go. And with the kind of caveat that we can't diagnose over the phone, that there may be something's going on where the doctor actually needs to see the patient. That's something you always need to keep in mind. But, of course, we welcome the questions. That's why we do these shows. I know he'll do his best to help you out, give you some basic information, and then maybe you might want to pursue that with your own pediatrician or your own family doctor. But this is a good place to start. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And email, you can also send your questions that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much.
Morning.
For being here. We appreciate it. Let's go right ahead to, we have a caller here ready to go, someone who is on line number two and in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. My daughter is just turning 6 months old, and she currently only uses a pacifier to fall asleep. However, she has to have it to go to sleep, which means that when she wakes up during a nap or during the night, she's reliant on us coming and putting it back in rather than her being able to put herself back to sleep. So we're sort of seeing this go down the road of a bad habit, and we were wondering what your thoughts were on appropriate pacifier use and how and when to wean them from it before it becomes a problem. Thanks.
Okay.
That's a good question. Kind of relates to bedtime habits in general, and you've picked up on this very clearly. Infants would be helpful for them to learn to fall asleep without help from parents or other aides because if they do wake up in the middle of the night, which children and infants do frequently, they have trouble getting back to sleep unless they use the same device or the same routine. So if a pacifier is part of the bedtime routine, when they wake up, they need it back again. And since they can't get it themselves, parent has to go back in. So it's not just a pacifier. It could be holding them till they fall asleep, feeding them till they fall asleep, those kind of things. All kind of are habits that create problems at bedtime. So ideally, a baby should be put to in their crib before they're asleep, when they're still awake but sleepy, probably without a pacifier, certainly not being fed to sleep, and learn to develop a rhythm on their own so that they can fall asleep. And then when they wake up in the middle of the night, they're fine. They go back to sleep. You don't even know it. You know, little wake-ups occur all night long for people. But you'll know it if they don't have a good habit or a good routine to help. The other thing that aggravates this, at 6 to 10 months, babies develop this separation anxiety, they call it, when actually they wake up, they were happy and okay before, but now they miss their parents and want their parents back in, so that really aggravates or complicates. So in this situation, unfortunately, pacifier use maybe should be limited to daytime, waking time, and they probably just going to have to pull the plug, if you will, at bedtime, and the child's going to have to kind of deal with it in their own way. It may not be easy, but they probably need to learn to fall asleep without their pacifier, and that's a tough lesson for them to learn. They will do some crying, but it may be short-term, get some support from family members. I think both parents have to agree on this because one parent may not want to hear the crying, the other parent may be able to put up with it.
Do you have any suggestions for non-crying methods to get them away from using the pacifier?
Well, it's substitution, but if you're going to substitute something for the pacifier, it's going to be difficult because
okay.
that's their habit. Little things in a crib probably are not safe, like big stuffed animals and things like that. So, you can transition them at bedtime. In other words, you're putting them down. You don't have to let them cry for extended periods. You can put them down, talk with them, kind of work with them while they're falling asleep, and then slowly withdraw that support. But it's unfortunately just a hard lesson to learn. So.
And when do you see as an upper limit age-wise for acceptable pacifier use? I know some toddlers
right.
become sort of addicted to them.
Right. Normally what I do is if they're getting into the chewing phase, substitute some teething toys and things of that sort, even at 6 or 8 months, see if you can work away from the pacifier. By two, though, generally I just have a no-replacement policy, so if it's stolen, lost, or deteriorates, just don't replace it and just lump it, is what I would recommend. As far as damage, though, the only issues with pacifiers are really, just the issue of cleanliness. And later on when they get to be older, the overbites and things of this sort can be an issue, but it's not really a big health problem. But I just go ahead, and that's my opinion.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. That was something that it seems to me that a long time ago, at least, when people talked about issues with either pacifier use or thumb sucking and all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff, that one of the big things always was, well, that really it interfered with the normal development of dentition, mm-hmm. and you end up with tooth problems because it gets things distorted, particularly, I guess maybe it was thumb sucking. The idea was that what you're ending up doing is you're pushing mm-hmm. the upper teeth outwards, and
right.
so you do end up with problems. So that actually is, there is some truth to that?
If you use a pacifier beyond age 3, sure. I mean, but once you start losing your baby teeth, if you will, primary teeth, if you're a thumb sucker, then you may well have some orthodontic issues to deal with, which is cosmetic, but also they found that kids that have very protruding front teeth have a higher incidence of fractures of those teeth. So, mm-hmm. It actually becomes an issue for the older kids. And our dentists have ways of dealing with that with some appliances and things. And there's some behavioral things that you can do as well for the kids that are still thumb sucking at 5, 6, 7 years of age.
Okay. When just now, it raises the question in my mind, now is it recommended that a child should have a first visit with a dentist?
The recommendation now is age 2 if there are no problems from the American mm-hmm. Academy of Pediatrics. But again, the pediatric dentists recommend first tooth, but I'm not sure how that plays out. But I think certainly between 2 and 3, we're seeing more cavities in kids. And certainly it's good to have fluoride in the water. That helps a lot. Start brushing when the teeth come in. Get in the habit of it. Fluorinated toothpaste when the kids can spit their toothpaste out. And nothing in the mouth in terms of calories or food or anything, nothing in the mouth after bedtime, because I think some kids have the habit of feeding in the middle of the night, taking a bottle to bed with them. Those are or nursing all night. That mm-hmm. that's really hard on the teeth. Matter of fact, breast milk was more, if you want to say, cavity promoting than even cow's milk. So even
really?
Breast milk can be an issue for kids that like to nurse all night.
Yeah.
So,
okay. Another caller here, someone in Findlay. This is line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I have a son that is 13 years old, and we had an incident of high temp, uncontrollable muscle spasms, and was sent to the hospital. And then ran a bunch of tests, and a cancer doctor came in and was afraid that this was cancer-related. So we were sent over to St. Jude's Hospital over in Peoria. And they did some tests over there, and it turned out it was Epstein-Barr virus,
mm-hmm.
infectious disease. And they told us over there that this is going to affect him for the rest of his life. He's not going to have the stamina as he used to. And when he gets something again, it's going to hit him even harder than somebody that hasn't had Epstein-Barr virus. Well, then he came down with viral meningitis, and he was a pretty sick little boy, and just was wondering. He recovered fine from that, but boy, when he gets sick, he really gets sick. And I was wondering, how common is Epstein-Barr virus, and is there, I know there's no cure for it because it's going to remain in his system, but what should I be aware of and look for in the future?
So can I ask when he had the Epstein-Barr viral infection?
He had the Epstein-Barr viral infection 2 years ago.
2 years ago. Okay. And the meningitis?
The meningitis just occurred and just got through with it. And that was 2 weeks ago.
Okay. So summer. Okay.
Summer.
I'll talk about Epstein-Barr virus. So.
That'd be great. I'd love to hear more about that.
Yeah. I mean, it's a common virus, and we see that frequently in our practice. The common, of course, term is mononucleosis. If you have the symptoms of Epstein-Barr, it's one that most people recover from fully, thank goodness, because most of us had it.
Yeah.
Yeah, during our childhood or adolescence. And babies, it presents more vaguely, but in teenagers and young adults, fever, chills, swollen lymph nodes, various things, fatigue, and usually within 2 to 3 weeks you've recovered. And it's one of those viruses that sticks with you, just like chickenpox virus. But it doesn't necessarily cause chronic disease. As far as the literature goes, I'm sure if you read about it more, it's going to say most people recover fully. It doesn't cause an immunocompromised situation, as far as I'm concerned. Rarely. Can you have chronic kind of fatigue for 4 to 6 months following mono? But again, most of those people still recover. And then as far as infections go, as far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't think that your son would be more prone to anything serious. Viral meningitis is not a rare thing in the summer with some of the arboviruses and the enteroviruses, which he probably had, because we've seen a lot of enteroviruses lately with fever, sore throat, rashes. So I would be pretty optimistic, unless he has some kind of immune deficiency somewhere along the line that you didn't tell me about.
They ran tests on all that, because I really sent the red flag out, letting them know that he had that Epstein-Barr, and the doctors over at St. Jude were, you know, they really were wanting us to be alert and cautious when he gets older and he does get another illness, to let your pediatrician or when he gets older, his regular physician, when he gets up, let them know he had that Epstein-Barr, because that is something that they should be aware of.
And I think that's fine. I mean, I think if you look at probably the people over there that see the worst of worst kids,
I'm
sure they've seen some things that are kind of on the odd side, such as maybe a Hodgkin's lymphoma or something with somebody that has had Epstein-Barr virus. But that's still not a very common occurrence.
So, you see Epstein-Barr, you said it isn't that uncommon. It is more.
If you do blood tests on 100 people. Don't quote me on this. I'm sure 50 of them have had the infection during their lifetime.
Well, that is interesting. That makes me feel a little reassuring. Yeah.
I mean, how many people have you talked to that have had mono?
Now, mono, I have heard.
Okay, that mono is caused by Epstein-Barr virus.
And EBV. It is caused. Now, they did ask us over at St. Jude where he had been. And in the last month, and I said, well, we were over in California skiing at Incline Village.
No, the actual incubation period is 90 days for mono.
Right.
It's a very low-grade virus, 90 days, not 30.
90 days, right.
90 days.
She was just wondering where we had been on any trips. And we had been skiing out there at Incline Village.
Yeah.
And supposedly, she said, that is where it originated.
Okay.
In the Olympics.
Well, that's very interesting. I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of it either, but we happened. I mean, this was years ago when that came about, and we just happened to be there. But thank you for your.
I'm glad your son's doing well, and I think
he's doing well.
Tell him to wear his seatbelt. That's more important than anything.
More
wear
important.
A bike helmet, sunscreen, take good care of himself, eat a Healthy diet, okay.
All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much for your help.
Our guest this morning in this hour of focus is Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician at Carl in Urbana. And it's a show that we do occasionally here. We do a lot of different healthcare shows throughout the year, but every once in a while we want to do one that's very specifically closely focused on kids and their health. So if you have questions about children's health, he will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk about sunscreens. And, you know, throughout the summer, we have different doctors on here. It's something we always talk about, whether it's the family doctor, whether it's a dermatologist, whoever it is. And I feel like, well, I hope it doesn't sound like we're nagging, but we still do have a significant problem with skin cancer in this country. Mm-hmm. And the way to limit your risk, well, it's really pretty easy. It's not real complicated. And that is to, if we could get people to use sunscreen, that would go a long way mm-hmm. to help taking care of the problem.
There's a lot of things you can do, but I think there's a lot of confusion when it comes to sunscreens. And a lot of the people I've talked to recently have been doing, you know, the parents have been doing some research and have really learned some interesting things. But there's UVA and UVB. Those are two spectrums of ultraviolet. And the SPF factor is sun protection factor, if you will. And that relates to the UVB or the burning type of ultraviolet. UVA, they don't rate well. And so that's the one that penetrates the skin and really causes the skin cancer. So some sunscreens are better than others. So it's good to do some legwork. But for the UVA protection, I just wanted to go over that. Helioplex, titanium dioxide, zinc oxide are probably the best. So your products, you might want to check on that and see how they do with the UVA and UVB. And Consumer Report just rated a bunch, you know, you can look up. I'm not going to advertise. But I think, you know, pretty much you probably need to know what you're using. Some of the least expensive ones are better. So just because it says Target brand or Walmart doesn't mean that it's necessarily inferior to some of the more expensive sunscreens. But the other thing is, you know, if they avoid direct sunlight during the, you know, midday, gosh, you know, wear a hat, wear clothing. An interesting one was the RIT dye-free sun guard. You can put that in your wash, and it really helps filter the ultraviolet from your clothing for about 30 washes. So that's another interesting thing that one of our dermatologists tipped me off to.
Yeah, I think one of the other things, and I'm sure the dermatologists would say this too, that even when people are using sunscreen, they don't put on enough.
Right.
It's the recommended amount is more than maybe you would think. So that's if you're going to put it on, you also have to make sure that you put on an adequate amount.
I'm thinking they say about 2 ounces, you know, and people don't use 1/3 that. You can see some people with the same tube of sunscreen all summer. But that's interesting because, you know, they say SPF 30. Well, that's good if you put it on adequate amounts. But what you can do is if you go with SPF 60, 70, 80, you'll get a little better protection if you're kind of stingy with the sunscreen. So I just use the higher SPF factors, and that is important. Also, people need to put the sunscreen on 30 minutes before they go out to activate it. So I've noticed a lot of kids come in with burns around strap lines and around. So if you can put it on before the swimsuit or at least cover all areas well, that would help, because I see a lot of these around the edges of the swimsuit sunburns, which are kind of painful.
Yeah. Just recently we had on one of your colleagues here, one of the dermatologists, and she also said, and, you know, one of the things, and apparently this is something that people neglect, even adults really neglect, is the ear.
It's the ears.
And that you end up with people, and I guess particularly for those people who maybe they're just out in the sun a lot, they have a lot of occupational exposure, you end up with a lot of skin cancers around the ear. And I think about, when I think it on, to put it on, I put it on my face. Sure. I try to put it on the back of my neck. Mm-hmm. Do I put it on my ears?
No.
Don't.
Yeah. Golfers, farmers, people that work outside. Top of the feet, too. I see a few free burns there, too. So.
One other thing, and this also was something, actually, I think that came up in the Consumer Reports article, was they said they recommended that people not use products that combine sunscreen and insect repellent.
Why would you think that?
Well, apparently the idea is that if you're applying the amount of sunscreen that's recommended, you may be getting too much of the insect repellent.
Right.
So they say, don't do the two things together. Do the two things separately.
And I think another, in the same kind of vein as these over-the-counter products with multiple cold, cough, runny nose, and Tylenol, same deal. You can get into trouble by multiple doses of those things when you really just need Tylenol. But yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, so that then it kind of gets me at thinking about insect repellents.
Yes.
And whether there are particular things, particular cautions about using those products with children are.
Well, you know, I think certainly you would try to stick with reasonable concentrations of any product. And the most common, most effective insect repellent is DEET, D-E-E-T. Kids can tolerate between 10 and 30%. So if you do Skintastic or one of these products, usually it's pretty safe. My recommendations are to apply to the clothing and then tuck the clothing in well if you're talking about, you know, insects, ticks, this kind of thing. Apply it carefully around the face and exposed areas, but try to hit the clothing. And then wash it off when you come in from the outside, because I think anything that you can do to limit the exposure would be helpful. The non-DEET products are not as effective, but citronella, rosemary oil, Avon Skin So Soft with a bug guard, they do help, but you're going to get limited protection, but some protection. So those are certainly things you can do. Big thing for like mosquitoes and things is to avoid buggy times of day and in areas where there's lots of mosquitoes. And I think that's probably the best advice. Certainly for this is, you know, DEET's good for mosquitoes and ticks and things, not for bees and wasps and things of that sort. So that's a different issue altogether. So just avoid the flowery shirts and the smelly soaps if you want to.
Other than, looking and smelling like a flower, try not to do that.
And that's interesting. Another thing, too, is like drinking from soft drink cans where the bees will get in there. And so it's probably not a good idea. If you're allergic to wasps, or bees, you should not do that. You'll probably have been probably informed regarding all these things. And I think one of the things with the insect allergies, like the severe bee allergies, wasp allergies, they're finding that kids and adults need two doses of an EpiPen now about 30% of the time for major allergic reactions to these bees and wasps. So if you haven't heard that, you might talk to your doctor or allergist about making sure you have a twin pack, including for peanut allergies and things of that sort, because kids often need more than one dose to get them out of major trouble for those severe allergies. Yeah. So,
and once you have been bitten, particularly I guess I'm thinking here about mosquitoes, there are some people, you know, like me, for example, I get this reaction and they get all swollen up and they're pretty itchy. You know, sometimes it's all you can do to keep yourself from scratching.
Yeah.
Now, kids, it's going to be much harder to you tell them, okay, don't leave it alone. Mm-hmm. Anything that you can do to try to relieve the symptom of the itch?
Well, I want to bring up one thing, though. Those big welts that you get from a mosquito bite that are very local, occur where the bite occurs. It's not a true allergic reaction like you might think of with the bee sting or somebody that has a major allergic reaction. It's a very local reaction to the anticoagulant that the mosquito has. It's a protein kind of response. It itches like crazy. It does swell up, but it's not a big allergy. Benadryl helps a little bit with itching, but won't make the swelling go down. Mm. Cool compresses help a little bit. But prevention of the bite is the most important thing, because once it happens, it's really hard to treat. Topical steroids in high concentrations might help a little bit. One thing that happens with kids, though, now, they'll scratch and they'll develop an open wound. And we're seeing a lot of this methicillin-resistant staph, which is an infection, causes an abscess. So I think, you know, people would be careful about if they have a mosquito bite and they're scratching at it and it's, you know, they're developing an open wound, maybe an antibiotic ointment to prevent infection potentially reduce the infection rate for some of the bug bites.
And is that something you get over the counter, or you need a prescription?
For the like polysporin ointments, what I'm talking about, which is over the counter, don't use Neosporin. The dermatologist would not be happy with you because of the topical sensitization that can occur with Neosporin.
Well, let us talk with another caller. This is someone in Champaign. It's line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a granddaughter, 4 months old, up in the suburbs, last night at a temperature of 104. My daughter took her to ER. The tentative diagnosis was UTI. Ooh. And this morning she called me and said they had started IV antibiotic. The little baby's white count was 20,000, but the urine was clear. And the pediatrician had seen her and was thinking it's probably pneumonia. I was just wondering if you had any comments you could offer in general about the diagnosis and prognosis of pneumonia in infants.
Okay. A four-month-old with 104 fever probably should be evaluated very carefully. And what they did was probably check the urine, and they did a rapid test, and it might have been positive for some white cells. Mm-hmm. It probably should have a blood count, a blood culture, possibly, and maybe a chest X-ray if indicated.
Oh, that was done.
Okay. Now, as far as treatment goes, if the baby looks sick, then they typically will put the baby in the hospital, give them IV antibiotics, wait for culture results. So
yes.
If the urine's now clear, then basically it wasn't a urinary tract infection, but it was good that they checked. With pneumonia, it's basically based on the chest X-ray at this point because you don't really hear much in babies in terms of pneumonia. And then they will go through the process of trying to identify the type of pneumonia and cover with antibiotics till they can sort it out better. And it may all be viral. And so antibiotics may not be continued. So that's the work of the pediatrician there who's obviously covering the bases pretty well. Occasionally, if a baby looks sick, they'll do a lumbar puncture for spinal fluid, and that's mm-hmm. their judgment at 4 months. Luckily, it's interesting that we can talk about immunizations next, but four-month-olds hopefully have had two doses of their typical immunizations that we get, which cover the bad bugs that cause severe infections like pneumococcal disease or Haemophilus influenza disease. And so a lot of kids now that come up with these high fevers end up having viruses. And in the old days before the vaccines, maybe they had bacteria that were worse. So it's really we're seeing fewer and fewer kids with serious infections now, including pneumonia, meningitis, because of our vaccination programs that we're seeing. So hopefully it's a virus because we're seeing lots of kids with 104 fever right now, including babies.
Okay. Well, that answers the question.
All right. Very good.
You're
well,
welcome.
Thank you for the call.
Good luck
with
your granddaughter.
But midway through this hour of focus with Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carl in Urbana. We're talking about children's health, and questions are welcome. General questions, or it could be specific, very specific to your family. He'll do his best to answer. Again, as we always say on these shows, given that he can't see the patient, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu.
Are you going to let me jump in here on immunizations?
Yes, sir. You're the doctor.
Segue. I was giving you a lead into this.
Go for it.
There's some cool things. We mentioned the immunizations that kids get 2, 4, 6 months of age for meningitis and some serious infections. Mm-hmm. They've had an upgrade in the Prevnar vaccine, which is for pneumococcal meningitis. And the upgrade is called Prevnar 13 now, so that if your kids are coming in after completing this series, the old Prevnar, the pediatrician's probably going to recommend a booster dose of Prevnar 13, so don't be surprised at that one. I think it's a new recommendation in the last 3 weeks, Prevnar 13. You had also mentioned, David, about whooping cough. And over the last couple of years, they've developed a whooping cough booster for adults. Pertussis is the real name, which includes adolescents and young adults. So now they're recommending, instead of getting a tetanus booster, getting a tetanus booster with the whooping cough booster at least once. So your internist or family doctor, if you're in the adult range, should mention that. And we're doing a pretty good job at Carl. We've been on it for 2 years now. We're up to, like, I think 85 or 90% of the adults are being offered this vaccine. So.
And that's what's kind of interesting about that. I think over time, the finding was that we'd done a pretty good job with the little kids getting them the shots for pertussis.
Right.
But what was happening is that we were having adolescents and adults who actually had it,
right,
but not – their symptoms were much less, but the problem is that then they still were spreading it.
Right.
So what we wanted to do was make sure is if we could get everybody immunized, then the thought was pretty much we could get rid of pertussis.
Or limit it.
Maybe get rid of it, but we'd have a lot less.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where the immunity for the pertussis is not permanent. You get your last dose, or in the past, your last dose at age 5, and then, you're, left with waning immunity. And, the problem with that is that adults then become infected and carry, they cough. Sometimes, actually, adults become very sick with whooping cough, believe it or not. And we've had some people in the intensive care unit with whooping cough in their 50s, 60s. So it's not necessarily a benign disease in adults. But what happens is kids that are not fully immunized or under 2 months who haven't had immunizations, come in contact with someone with a cough. If it's whooping cough, then they can become very ill with like 50% mortality rate for kids under 2 with whooping cough. It's the ugliest thing I think I've seen in terms of disease as a pediatrician. So the mothers tend to be the person that carries it about a third of the time too. So really there's a push for moms that are pregnant or deliver to be immunized. For whooping cough.
And so there's a recommendation for tetanus that everybody get a booster on that every 10 years. So now what you're doing is you're folding the pertussis into that. Mm-hmm. So eventually the idea is that we'll get everybody and we'll catch them every 10 years. So now instead of just doing the tetanus, they'll get – and they're bundled together. So it's
I understand it, since I don't take care of adults, I think they're required they're suggesting one booster at some point.
Time on the whooping cough, that's good.
Somebody may have to correct me on that, but I think that's the way that this has been licensed and designed. But
every 10 years?
For tetanus? Mm-hmm. Unless you have a deep wound or a cut, then it's 5. So if you come in with a puncture wound, a dog bite, a nasty laceration, have to have sutures, they're going to give you a tetanus. If it's been 5 or more years.
Okay, just to make sure you
darn
don't get
right.
any injury problems, because the bugs that cause tetanus, it's actually something that's out there in the environment.
It's everywhere.
It's all around.
Sure.
And it doesn't have anything to do with stepping on a rusty nail.
No,
it has to do with having a deep puncture wound.
Yes, it's a Clostridia bacteria that likes to be in the dark and without oxygen, so puncture wounds or deep wounds, yes.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Ugly bug.
We have another caller here, Batavia. We'll go there. Line 4. Hello.
Yeah, I got a question for you here. I got I have Meniere's disease, vertigo.
Okay.
And I just started acting up. So every time I take and go to the dentist, I'd say the next day I start having these, the vertigo starts kicking in.
Yeah.
Now, right now it's not bad, but and I'm just wondering, is there anything, I'm taking tramadol right now, but is there anything else I could do? I don't have it very often. I mean, the last time I had it was probably a year and a half ago,
okay. Maybe. I was just going to say, I'm a pediatrician, and I don't deal with Meniere's disease, because typically that's an adult disease. But I had one question for you. Do you have hearing loss?
Somewhat. Not
do you? Okay. Yeah, I mean, there's a condition called benign positional vertigo, and it happens a lot in adults. And it has to do with your position. So, for instance, if you're in a dental chair and laying back, you're lying back for a period of time, especially if your head's in one direction or the other, it shifts the little otoliths in your middle ear and in your inner ear, and that can cause pretty significant vertigo for a time period. So it just might be something you might bring up with your doctor, because it may not be the Meniere's disease with the dentist. It may be you have a positional vertigo, which is really pretty common.
It's not like he doesn't put me all the way down. It's just, in fact, my head is kind of like laying like I normally would in bed. So,
okay, just a thought.
The dentist, they have the same thing, and it's like. But anyway, I just caught it in the middle of the conversation. I didn't realize that. You were just a pediatrician.
Oh, no problem. No problem. But, yeah, we have a couple of physicians that specialize in ears, and one particularly in inner ear problems at Carl, but maybe it'd be a good question for Dr. Novak or one of the ENT people. So thank you for calling.
Thanks for the call. We got about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus, talking about children's health with pediatrician Dr. Malcolm Hill. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk.
I have another issue, David.
Yeah, yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes,
so,
sir.
So actually, summertime's a real big time for injuries and things. The kids are out playing and all that. So,
right. So
I was working in my yard last week, thinking about today, maybe talking about a few things. And it was about 7:30 at night, getting a little darker, and I watched this teenager riding down the road on his bicycle. No helmet, of course, no surprise. No hands on the handlebar. Wrong side of the road. Texting.
I was about to say, was he talking on the phone?
He was texting.
That's why he was writing with no hands, because
I don't texting. Know. But and so, you know, I thought, my gosh, you know, they talk about driving cars and texting, and I see that all the time, people talking on phones and, you know, and bicycles. I didn't think about it, you know, but actually I pulled a report, and head injuries are way up. And a lot of it is related to bicycles, and a fair number of it's related to kids doing other things like texting or iPods or... And, you know, you also have an iPod, you know, with the speakers blaring. You can't hear what's going on behind you. You're not paying attention. You know, I think we need to take driving cars seriously, but I think people need to think about these bikes.
Well, it's really interesting because, it seems over the last year or so, there's been so much attention paid to the problem of distracted driving.
Right, right.
And maybe we should also be talking with kids about distracted cycling.
Yeah, it's more now than before. I mean, yeah. I think kids used to ride double, and, you know, they don't necessarily pay attention because they don't think you're going to get hurt on a bicycle. But I discourage people from doing that. And, the driving issue is if I'm, you know, riding a bike can be very dangerous nowadays between people running red lights, texting, you know, veering off the road. I'm not even feeling safe about riding my bike now out in traffic, you know, because I think people are very distracted now when they're driving. So I'd be really careful out there if I'm riding a bike, even if I'm really not texting or anything else. I'd really wear bright clothing and gear up well and watch drivers. Yeah. You know.
Well, pediatricians, particularly for a long time now, I know that you all have been on a campaign to get children to wear helmets when they're riding bikes.
Right.
I wonder how well do you think that's gone. I suppose all you have to do is look around and you can actually see how well that's gone. Maybe really little kids, particularly if they're out with parents, they're riding helmets. But, you know, there's really nothing when your child is out of your sight, you don't know what it is they're going to be doing.
That's true. I mean, we talked about this before, but you need several things. One is you need education of parents and kids. Two is you need probably a bike helmet law with some teeth. And if you don't have those things, then probably your success rate's going to be, you know, minimal compared to cities like Atlanta and all this, where you actually, if you don't have a helmet on, you get a ticket. And people, you know, we talked about this before. I don't think it's a popular subject for the city, for anybody that is in law enforcement, because that sounds like a bad job to me. But I think overall, hopefully, we can educate the population and do the best we can. Parents, you know, just you have to be firm about certain things and you're going to get a fight. But helmets are now easier to adjust. They're more comfortable. You know, the little kids obviously love them. And the big rub is the middle schooler and high schoolers and things of this sort that it ain't cool and it's uncomfortable for them and they don't want to wear the helmets. But I don't have anything else I can really add to that.
Yeah. So. Well, let's talk with another caller. We have somebody in Normal. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. I would like to ask a question about child development. I have a 5-month-old granddaughter, and it seems to me, and this is just my opinion from when I was raising my daughter, that babies that now are sleeping on their backs instead of on their stomachs, I wonder if they develop their muscles, like for crawling or for sitting or whatever, slower than they used to when they used to sleep on their stomachs. Is there any correlation there?
There's a couple of things that I've noticed that you also have maybe been noticing is that babies spend a lot of time on their back now. They're more comfortable on their back, and they don't like to be on their abdomen as much.
Right.
And so their heads become a little flat or sometimes misshapen. They complain when they get on their stomach, so they don't get the upper body kind of exercise that they had in the past. And so what I've done is I pay particular attention to that and kind of ask the parents to, you know, put the kids on their abdomen more. The tummy time is what these pediatricians refer to, which is kind of an interesting term. And I think it certainly does do a couple of things. The kids roll over later. They may sit up a little bit later, but not significantly, not in a delayed way. Crawling, probably if you were on your back all the time, yeah, you would have a delay probably in crawling. But I think if people can just use the awake time of day to get the kids on their belly, and that would help. The other thing, too, is if they go from their back and then people start putting them in these infant seats or walkers or these jumpers or any of these kind of devices, then that takes away that kind of exercise as well. So I also don't recommend using devices like that to put babies in to sit up other than just briefly. So, yeah, so you've noticed some things, I'm sure.
Yes, I have. I was thinking her pace is not the same pace as my daughter because that was back in the days when they were they were on their stomachs, and she spent a lot of, you know, some time in the playpen just almost doing like like push-ups or whatever.
I think the thing, though, with the sleeping on the back has been really impressive. They had a 50% reduction in the crib death or infant death when that was done. So there's no doubt that that still needs to be carefully, I guess, enforced, if you will. So including naps, daycares, everywhere. So, but well, congratulations. Have a granddaughter, huh?
Thank you.
All right.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Okay. This
was something I actually had made it based on something that just came to my mind earlier. I had made a note about bringing up, and that was, it seemed to me that going back, I don't know how many years, like 10, 15 years maybe, there was there seemed to be a lot of concern about sudden infant death syndrome, and that there had been apparently then a study done, a finding that doing one very simple thing, and that was putting kids to sleep on their backs rather than their tummies, cut down very significant. I mean, it didn't
50%.
Completely go away, but there was this real big decline in SIDS. So then at that point, the advice was for sleeping was don't put them down on their backs, don't put them down on their stomachs.
Exactly. Yeah, they measured, what they've done is they looked at infants sleeping on their back and on their stomach, and they found that actually infants sleep better, deeper, arouse less frequently, and it's harder to arouse them when they're on their stomach. So the point being, obviously, that babies don't wake up when they need to, when they have their face buried in a mattress or in something, and so then they don't arouse, and then they die. So, you know, they don't sleep as well on their back, but that's saving their life. So it's a complaint I hear, but I still, you know, obviously recommend sleeping on the back.
So is there now some thinking, though, about in these other 50% of the cases that didn't get solved just by changing the sleeping position, what really is going on?
With sudden infant death?
Sudden infant death?
You know, there's probably multiple causes, and I don't think I can give you one answer. The risk factors are, unfortunately, you know, like prematurity, maternal smoking. And then there's a good number that had environmental issues. If they go back and look at the crib, or they look at the mattress, or they fall in between the mattress and the crib, there was definitely some environmental factors, so that people were not probably positioning the babies correctly, or they were in an unsafe crib, or sleeping with the parent.
I was going to ask you about that.
Or parent drinking and sleeping
back
with the child.
When we went back to the very first question where the caller was asking about pacifiers, and you were talking about, you know, what about this situation where the child wakes up in the middle of the night, and you know, how do you get them to go back to sleep? And I suppose that some people would say, well, or if they might bring them into their bed, maybe if they're old enough so that they come then, you know, and say, Mommy, Daddy, I can't sleep.
Well, if they're walking into your bedroom, you're probably okay with injuries go. But infants, unfortunately, they've had some rollovers and things of this sort. Babies sleeping on mattresses, and you can imagine the problems with that when a parent's snuggled up against you, or two parents. It's not the safest. in general. Now, some certain cultures, that's just the way it is. And for whatever reason, you know, that may work out for that particular culture. But in general, the recommendations are not sleep with the parent because of the problems.
Yeah. All right. About 5 minutes left here maybe with Dr. Hill, Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carl. And if you have questions about children's health, you can call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email well-talk@illinois.edu. Well, now, we talked about a number of things particularly that have to do with safety and summer, and we've talked about sunscreens and insect repellents, and we talked about wearing your helmet when you ride your bike, and don't text when you're riding your bike.
Oh.
Is there anything else in particular that has to do with summer and the fact that kids are going to be much more active? They're going to be outside. They're going to be running around and riding their bikes and mm-hmm. swimming and doing, you know, whatever else. Mm-hmm. Anything in particular that has to do with safety, you know, home safety?
There's so many things, but I think, of course, in the summertime, you pull out all sorts of things for lawn and garden and gasoline and, you know, make sure you store things properly, because toddlers will get into just about anything.
Yeah.
And especially if it's not labeled correctly, you don't know what they're getting into. Lawnmowers. You know, I see a lot of little kids mowing lawns, and I think beware. If you're under 12 years of age, you probably shouldn't be mowing a lawn without very close supervision. And so be aware of that. I also occasionally see people driving, you know, with their riding lawnmower with their kid on the lawnmower, or backing up and mowing and with little kids outside. And I spent, unfortunately, a year in working nights at St. Vincent's Hospital in Indianapolis, where the major job there for the pediatric floor was to take care of kids medically that had their arms, legs amputated or whatever from lawnmowers. So
really?
they actually specialized in lawnmower injuries, and like 30% of amputation of kids are caused by lawnmowers. So generally, the young kids shouldn't be out mowing without supervision. Don't mow unless kids are inside under five. Don't back up either. A lot of it's backup injuries where they're mowing in reverse and the kid's behind them, they didn't know it. Kids fall off the mower. And, you know, I've seen kids with tractor mowers actually turn over in ditches and things, and that, or adults too. So I just think you should really supervise very carefully when it comes to lawnmowers.
Yeah. Well, then that's good for even for adults, you know.
Yes.
You're using lawnmowers, using hedge trimmers, using
right.
chainsaws,
right.
you know, and all that kind of stuff. You got to be really careful.
Yeah,
and they're fine things, and they're mm-hmm. great, you know, they get the job done.
Right.
But, you know, real basic safety mm-hmm. stuff,
no,
you really need to be paying, and no matter who you are, you really need to be paying attention to what you're doing.
Agreed.
And, yeah, and if you're really doing it right, you should wear eye protection.
Absolutely.
And good,
hearing.
Sturdy, something for your ears,
it's
and good, sturdy shoes,
yeah,
and,
shoes.
You know, all
right.
that kind of stuff. You got to be really careful. We'll see if we can get a couple more calls in here. Champagne is next. Line one. Hello.
Is this us?
Yes.
Oh, hi. We were wondering if the pediatrician could let us know, like, what kind of things should be looking for, whether we should take our child to the pediatrician if they get a lot of bug bites. Like, how do we know if it's a bug bite or if it's something else?
Oh, it's a toughie. Actually, some of the bug bites look pretty mean.
Yeah.
I would, yeah, really. I mean, some swelling. If you get bit on the face, around the eyes swell up. Typically, if you see the bug bite, that's nice. If it starts with a red swollen area about the, you know, about a, you know, quarter of an inch in size, and becomes swollen maybe to the size of a nickel, that's probably acceptable. If it's draining or if it looks like there's pus from it, obviously that's an infection. Short of that, you know, shouldn't be any fever with bug bites.
No.
Shouldn't be any streaky lines going out of it. And shouldn't be painful. Most bug bites, when you come in and you see this red swollen area, you go to the kid, does it itch or hurt? It itches. If it's itching, you're probably okay. But the best thing to do this time of year, if you have a child that responds pretty aggressively and significantly to these mosquito bites, is try to prevent them, because they're
right,
ugly.
Yeah, that's what we've been doing.
They're ugly.
Follow up on that, actually. What if it feels kind of hard underneath where
hard,
they've been scratching?
That's pretty normal. It
okay.
gets very tense. It's called, it's kind of a local reaction mediated by this thing called cell-mediated immunity. So it really causes a lot of swelling and very hard swelling. Yeah. Yeah. It's difficult.
Okay. No, I hope that gets at the question. We're trying to get one more real quick, and this is somebody who's on a cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This will be very quick.
Great.
When I raised my children, we put them on their tummies to sleep. I had a neighbor at that time, though, gave her baby some water and put it on his back. Went to take a bath, and when she came back, the child was struggling to breathe. And she ran over to my house, and I held him by the feet and gave him a whack on the back, and out came water. Now, I do not understand why they've switched from, I mean, I know about SID, but it seems to me that the risk of choking is more severe or more likely than SID.
That was the major concern that all the nurses had in the hospital, all the doctors, we had the same feeling. And so what they did was they did research where they gave babies, they fed them and put them down on their back, and they fed them and put them down on their stomach. And they found that actually that the babies on their stomach spit up more, and the babies on the back, when they spit up, it could clear the airway. Now, I don't know if this mother gave the child something in the crib on the back or fed the child and put the child down, but in general, it's safe, and, yeah, it doesn't appear to be a problem. It's kind of like somebody that says, I don't wear my seatbelt because, you know, there's an accident. There was an accident last year where a guy drowned. Well, most accidents, you do better in your seatbelt. So it may be one of those odd situations, but apparently that's not a problem. And I know it was researched, and that's a great comment because I think people are afraid of that.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to stop. There, we've ended the time. We want to thank our guest, Dr. Malcolm Hill. He's a pediatrician from Carl in Urbana. Thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.